You are listening to The Phoenix, where science is stranger than fiction. We will discover both the enigmatic and absurd side of science, including biology, the animal kingdom, and even the paranormal.
Hello there, my fellow scientist wannabes. I'm the Phoenix, your host. Welcome to the Phoenix Podcast, where science is stranger than fiction. I want to thank you for listening. As I always am very grateful for all of you out there downloading the podcast or listening on toginet.com. And again, if you ever have the urge, go to www.blazingtalons.com, where you can read some of my weekly posts on the absurd side of science. Now today's episode's gonna be chock full of science news, another wacky invention segment, since all of you loved my singing from the last episode, and we'll talk about near-death experiences. It's a full show, I hope you enjoy it. You're listening to the Phoenix Podcast, where science is stranger than fiction. Our first story comes from the Daily Mail and involves a new species of chimpanzees being discovered. Scientists are learning more about giant lion-eating apes of the Congo, known officially as the Bili or Bondo ape. There have been many tales about the giant, unusual apes, which have been noted by Western explorers since the late 1890s. And now, it seems the Congolese mystery ape is finally coming into the spotlight of scientific respectability. See, the Congolese people have long told Western explorers and biologists about a species of ape which looks like a huge chimpanzee, but yet sleeps on the ground like a gorilla and hunts big cats for food. A Swiss photographer named Carl Ammann visited the area in 1996 and found a skull which was similar in size to that of a regular chimp, but had a prominent bony crest like a gorilla. And at first they're wondering maybe this was a chimpanzee-gorilla hybrid. Genetically speaking, that's quite possible. Or maybe it was a new species of chimpanzee, but they just weren't sure. But what got Ammann's attention was when he got a hold of a photograph taken by hunters, which appeared to show a humongous chimpanzee. And you've got to see this thing. I'll put a picture of it up on my website, blazingtalons.com, to go along with the show notes for this episode. But this thing is huge. And either that or the locals are really tiny. But, I mean, this chimp is gigantic. And it's kind of freaky looking. I mean, it's strange. He then recounted what the locals have been telling him about these animals. They said that the gorilla males will always charge when they're faced with a hunter or a human. And of course it's a real scary thing, but these other apes instead would come literally face to face with the hunters, stare at them in the eyes, kind of, you know, study them a little bit, and then slowly slink away. No aggression, but no fear either. In 2004, Shelley Williams, a scientist that's affiliated with the Jane Goodall Institute, also had an experience with these giant chimpanzees. She wrote, "We could hear them in the trees about 20 feet away, and four suddenly came rushing through the bush towards me. If this had been a bluff charge, they would have been screaming to intimidate us. These guys were quiet, and they were huge." She goes on to describe what these chimps look like. She said the apes had a flat face with a wide muzzle, and most strikingly, gray fur all over their face and bodies. Of course, this report was met with a lot of skepticism, but most scientists were convinced that there was something going on in the Congo jungle. Most recently, researcher Cleve Hicks at the University of Amsterdam has spent 18 months observing the billy apes at close quarters. What he found was intriguing: a population of humongous, gigantic chimpanzees with their own distinct culture and, indeed, a liking and an ability to hunt big cats for food. One was even seen scavenging on the carcass of a leopard, although it's not known if the ape had killed the cat himself. He says, "The adult males do appear to be larger than the average chimpanzee male," Hicks writes in his latest report, "although I doubt nearly as large as gorilla males. Perhaps the main difference between these large chimps and regular chimps is their fearlessness of humans. Most normal chimpanzees instinctively flee when they see a human being. However, the ginormous chimps approached the researchers with curiosity and even a gentleness. Other differences include the fact that these chimps live predominantly on the ground, much like a gorilla, in large nests of twigs and foliage. Why they do so is unclear, as most chimps like to sleep high in the trees, safe from predators. But I guess, judging by the size of these chimps, they really don't have much to fear at all. It's becoming more clear that these giant chimpanzees are not simply some sort of mutation of regular chimps, that they are a specific and unique class of primates."
"Took your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!"
And our second story deals with psychology, particularly the psychology of aggressive people. This is out of Life Science, and the study found that aggressive men say no to free money. Money apparently isn't everything for men with lots of testosterone. In a new study, 26 male Harvard students were presented with ultimatums. Each was offered $5 out of a possible $40 by another person. A student could either take the $5 and leave the rest to the offerer, or both parties got absolutely nothing. And this experiment was actually played for real stakes. In other words, the students got to keep the money. But before this whole experiment began, Harvard economist Terrence Burnham took saliva samples from the students and later tested it for testosterone levels. He found that while 20 men took the $5 offer, 6 higher testosterone men rejected it. He said, "It's strange but true. It's strange, but it's true. People at times walk away from free money. If you knew the testosterone levels of these people, you didn't need to know much more to predict behavior, not what culture they were from, nor their political beliefs. Economists have long found that people reject offers of free money if they feel that they're getting the short end of the stick, or as I like to call it, up your ass syndrome. In a standard rational analysis, no one would ever reject free money," Burnham said. "If you get $5 or nothing, how smart do you have to be to figure that out? Most economists were so sure of what would happen, no one actually ran experiment with real people until 1982. And that was the big surprise finding. People do reject free money." At first, these researchers thought that they had screwed up their study. But he said, "But it's true, verified hundreds of times now. If you go around the world, it's true for everyone. They found it in 15 cultures, even cultures that don't use money often, like hunter-gatherers. People will often reject relatively large sums of money, such as 2 weeks' worth of wages, if their offers are roughly only one-fifth or less of the stakes involved, Burnham said. The findings shed light on the machinery in our brains that drive such behavior, Burnham finds. For instance, testosterone is linked with aggression, and low offers might signify a challenge. It would be considered insulting, Burnham explained. In a real-life negotiation, people have to understand that there's often more than just money at stake. There are other parts of the psyche to deal with, Burnham said. Personally, looking at this whole study, it also explains maybe why ambulance chaser lawyers have absolutely no problems finding greedy clients.
Do you want to go to war? Do you want to go to war? We'll take you to war.
You tell your guys, I kill a communist for fun. I'm gonna carve him up real nice.
Our next story comes from Wired News. Canadian researchers report they have solved checkers, developing a program they've named Chinook that cannot lose in a game popular with young and old alike for more than 1,000 years. The program can achieve at least a draw against any opponent playing either the black or the white pieces, the researchers say in this week's online edition of the journal Science. Here in the States, checkers is played with black and red pieces, by the way. Every combination of 10 checkers offers 39 trillion positions for the endgame, he said. Chinook can calculate them all. It does not matter how the players make it to 10 checkers left, because from that point on, the computer cannot lose, researchers say. For two players who never make a mistake, every game would be a draw. Next week, Polaris, a poker-playing computer program built by the same researchers, will challenge two poker professionals in a $50,000 man-versus-machine poker game in Vancouver, British Columbia, as part of the annual conference for the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. The checkers research was supported by the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, Alberta's Provincial Technology Organization, or ICOR, Canada Foundation for Innovation, Western Canada Research Grid, and the University of Alberta. Clearly, the world is not going to be revolutionized by this, Jonathan Schaefer, chairman of the Department of Computing Science at the University of Alberta, says. You know, I'd have to agree with Mr. Schaefer. Aren't there more pressing issues that Canadian scientists should be working on? Maybe like mad cow disease, or perhaps how to stop their population from saying a boot?
Oh, you farted. No, it wasn't me. It was the chair, eh?
He's lying. No. Check the machine, eh?
I'm not lying.
He's lying, all right.
I don't need no machine to tell me that, eh?
I didn't do it, I swear.
Oh, geez, don't slice cheese. Hey, will you take off?
And our final science news story of the day is concerning sharks and music. I did a post on this just last week, but in Germany, scientists study what kinds of music could help put sharks in the mood for copulation. At 10 of the different aquarium sites in Germany, the sharks are relatively young, and they haven't had the education and exposure to their adult sharks having sex, and they weren't able to model that behavior. So scientists are trying to figure out maybe music, certain kinds of music, will get the sharks to reproduce. So what they did was, over the course of several months, they played songs for a couple hours a day, and the scientists and the visitors were able to watch the sharks, and of course, I mean, there are some measurable things as far as how many eggs were produced and all this other stuff during certain songs. And from this big experiment in which over 1,000 songs were played, the scientists came up with a list of 5 songs that seemed to get sharks in the mood. And what I wanted to do was do just a quick countdown of these top 5 songs. And these are songs that you would not probably even guess, if you were to guess, that these songs would actually get sharks or humans or anybody in the mood for that matter. Anyway, number 5, Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry. The number 4 song to get sharks in the mood, Justin Timberlake's Rock Your Body. Number 3, it's confusing, James Last's Traumschiff, which is basically the German version the theme song to The Love Boat. And I'll play that for you here in a second. It sounds nothing like the American version of that theme song for that TV show, which I used to watch religiously, along with Fantasy Island that came on after that. Joe Cocker's You Can Leave Your Hat On. Apparently, again, this is just music, and sharks have no idea what Joe Cocker looks like when he's singing. Although he looks like he's having an orgasm when he's singing. Either that or some sort of epileptic seizure. But anyway, the number one song to get sharks in the mood for love is Salt and Pepper's Push It. Remember when the video came out, Salt and Pepper had their uneven hair and the gold chains and stuff? I wonder how much one of those salt and pepper leather jackets would go for on eBay. Now, again, going back to number three, Traumschiff, which is the German theme version of the Love Boat song. I mean, it's really bizarre. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to first play for you the theme song most of us know and love, the actual theme song to The Love Boat.
Love,
you know you want to sing along.
Exciting and new, come aboard. We're expecting you,
great love.
Life's sweetest reward.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let it flow.
Let it flow, baby.
It floats back to you. Love boat. Soon we'll be making another run. Love boat. Promises something for everyone.
Okay, enough of that. All right. Now, here is the German version of their own TV show, which is supposed to be The Love Boat. It's called Das Traumschiff. Yeah, can you imagine sharks making love to this? Me neither. All right, but keep in mind, these are the same people that idolize David Hasselhoff, okay?
Wacky Inventions.
And Wacky Inventions. Okay, I did a post, wow, back in October 7th, 2005. And it was a post on this great invention by a guy by the name of Greg Miller. And Greg was, he's actually from Independence, Missouri, so he's a fellow Missourian. And he came up with the idea of his inventions called nudicles, which is basically, to put it simply, it's prosthetic testicles for canines. And his dog, Buck, was neutered, and after the surgery he noticed that his dog was just not the same. I mean, he was lacking that canine confidence that he had had before the surgery. So what Miller did was he created these silicone balls for his dog, and what he did was he patented his invention. It's a great invention. You can go to nudicles.com. That's NEUTICLES.com. It's a very real product you can buy for your pet if you want. And this is my little commercial here for nudicles.
The Phoenix Podcast presents Real Genius Men.
Real Genius Men.
Today we salute you, Mr. Canine Testicle Implant Inventor.
Mr. Canine Testicle Implant Inventor.
You recognize that Fido just wasn't himself after being neutered. He didn't want to fetch, shake hands, or lick his own ass.
Oh, I think there's something missing!
He cared about man's best friend and recognized that he felt like less of a male after the surgery. You figured, hey, if you had your own balls cut off, you wouldn't be a happy camper either.
Rob, get that knife away from
me! While playing Game of Marbles, you came up with the answer. Nudicles. Or prosthetic balls for your puppy.
Not the kind of balls to play fetch with!
So, stand to be recognized, protector of the canine conies. And do you have prosthetic balls for my little chihuahua?
Mr. Canine Testicle and Blend Vendor!
More information, go to nudicles.com.
A middle-aged woman had a heart attack and was taken to the hospital. While on the operating table, she had a near-death experience. And seeing God, she asked if this was it. And God said, no, you have another 43 years, 2 months, and 8 days to live. Upon recovery, the woman decided to stay in the hospital and have a facelift, liposuction, breast augmentation, and tummy tuck. She even had someone come in and change her hair color. Since she had so much more time to live, well, she figured she might as well make the most of it. She got out of the hospital after the last operation, and while crossing the street was killed by an ambulance speeding to the hospital. And arriving in front of God, she demanded, I thought you said I had another 40 years! And God replied, sorry, I didn't recognize you. Thank you. Oh, you're so kind. Thank you. I'll be here all week. The topic of near-death experience is one that seems to be shrouded in mystery, and often people treat it as if it really belongs in the whole paranormal realm. However, out of any topic I can think of that's considered paranormal, near-death experience has probably received the most attention from the scientific community. Why? Probably because many of the witnesses in these near-death experiences are nurses and doctors. And many doctors have become more than curious as to what happens to some of their patients when they completely flatline or when they are brain dead. The topic of near-death experiences is ancient as time itself. There are many stories that are quite compelling. The skeptics argue that a near-death experience is simply leftover electrical impulses in the brain, that maybe the mind and the ego have this sort of self-defensive mechanism, this need to help cope with the dying, that it's sort of the brain's last gasp, so to speak. However, the issue I personally have with that is when you look at a lot of the data, the real true data that's out there, many times these patients that do have near-death experiences are clinically brain dead. That means absolutely no activity in the brain. And that completely shoots down that whole argument that it's, you know, little misfirings in the brain and whatnot. Because if they were, there would be brain activity, even a little bit. And for a skeptic to say, well, maybe it wasn't detected by the equipment, they're living in the 19th century. We have amazing technology that can pick up even the smallest impulses in the brain. And that argument doesn't make sense to me at all. So if there is some sort of explanation, non-spiritual anyway, explanation, it's not from the brain. So to me, the only answer really is that somehow, some way, consciousness does exist after you die, after your heart stops beating, after your brain is completely gone, that your consciousness still survives. And the thing is, with the near-death experience also comes another phenomenon close related, which is the out-of-body experience. Some of these people that have died and come back spoke about actually lifting out of their body and looking down. And this is where they witness many things happening to them that they otherwise would not be quite aware of. I mean, if someone is completely unconscious and brain dead, they are not able to read someone's name tag. However, some of these patients, when they lift out of their own bodies, they're looking around, and they said that they can see, like, the nurse's name tags. They can see what's hanging on the wall. They'll know what music is playing in the background. All sorts of details that suggest that they were quite conscious and quite aware of what's going on, despite what all of the medical instruments are telling the doctors. So what I wanted to do was just to share just a couple of these really interesting stories and let you judge for yourself. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you learn a couple of things and at least try to keep an open mind. Dr. Raymond Moody is known as being the father of near-death experience studies. His book, Life After Life, really took something that was seen as out there and, you know, paranormal, and brought it more into the mainstream and scientific communities. In Dr. Moody's book, he has many, many different testimonies, all of them well documented. So I wanted to share just a handful of these with you. The first one is from an elderly woman who had been blind since childhood, but during her near-death experience, the woman had regained her sight, and she was able to accurately describe the instruments and techniques used during the resuscitation of her body. After the woman was revived, she reported the details to her doctor. She was able to tell the doctor who came in and out, what they said, what they wore, what they did, all of which was true. Her doctor then referred the woman to Dr. Moody, who knew he was doing research at the time on near-death experiences. So here we have a case of a woman who necessarily might not have been brain dead. Okay, I'll give you that. But her heart had stopped, so she had clinically died. The issue here is she was blind. She's been blind since childhood. So if she was having misfirings in the brain and stuff from dying, then how the hell would she have been able to see things, such as the clothing, which nurses came in and out, and other details that the doctor was able to verify? So that one, to me, that example really shoots down a lot of the skeptics' arguments that near-death experiences are simply just leftover electrical activity in the brain. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't jive. Second story is from a patient that told Dr. Moody, "After it was all over, the doctor told me that I had a really bad time," and I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Well, how do you know?" And I said, "I can tell you everything that happened." He didn't believe me, so I told him the whole story. From the time I'd stopped breathing until the time I was kind of coming around, he was really shocked to know that I knew everything that had happened. He didn't know quite what to say, but he came in several times to ask me different things about it. In the second example, we have a person here who has a story very similar to the first lady, but this guy was able to relay specific details about what had occurred while he was supposedly dead. Presumably, this person doesn't have any medical training, medical experience, yet was able to relay a lot of the details as far as what was going on around him, the whole process, what the nurses did, and what the doctor had done. I think that's what really probably freaked out the doctor the most, that his patient that was supposed to be dead was able to give him such fine details. My third example is from a woman that had a heart condition, and she was dying at the same time that her sister was in a diabetic coma in another part of the same hospital. The subject reported having a conversation with her sister as both of them hovered near the ceiling watching the medical team work on her body below. When the woman awoke, she told the doctor that her sister had died while her own resuscitation was taking place. The doctor denied it, but when she insisted, he had a nurse check on it. The sister had, in fact, died during the time in question. Some people have reported that they visit their living loved ones, and others report being surrounded by old friends and family that had passed before them. There's always the typical, the out-of-body experience, floating upwards in the tunnel of light, and this sort of thing. And some people report having some sort of, not necessarily a judgment, but a life review. The interesting thing is a lot of the people that have near-death experiences that are not allowed to cross over into the spiritual realm, they're angry. They're upset. They're really pissed off when they wake up and they're in their bodies and they're suffering. They much would have rather been able to move forward and gone on and died and go through that process, it seems. So I find that really interesting as well. After Dr. Raymond Moody's book was published back in 1975, many scientists and doctors have tried to replicate Dr. Moody's work to see if his findings were verifiable. And interestingly enough, after going through thousands and thousands of first-hand testimony and verification by nurses and other physicians that were present during these near-death experiences, many of the researchers are pretty dumbfounded when they're trying to poke holes into this theory of NDEs, or near-death experiences. Dr. Ken Ring replicated the study that was performed by Dr. Moody years ago, and Dr. Ring's research concluded that, number one, Dr. Moody's research findings are confirmed. Number two, NDEs happen to people of all races, genders, ages, educations, marital status, and social class. Number three, religious orientation is not a factor. Number four, people are convinced of the reality of their near-death experience. Drugs do not appear to be a factor. And number six, NDEs are not hallucinations. Number seven, NDEs often involve unparalleled feelings. Number eight, people lose their fear of death and appreciate life more after having an NDE. And number nine, probably most importantly, people's lives are transformed after having an NDE. Your life isn't going to be transformed because of a hallucination. But secondly, for me, the scientific fact is, to have a hallucination, you have to have brain activity. If you don't have brain activity, guess what? You don't have hallucinations. One of the points that Dr. Ring had was the fact that these NDEs are occurring despite whatever a patient's religious background is. How about an atheist? Is an atheist going to have a near-death experience? They believe that we're just worm food after we die, and that's it. This story comes out of South Coast Today, down in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. In 1985, Howard Storm, who was 38 at the time, and his wife Beverly, were in Paris on the last day of an art tour. Buckled over by searing pain in the middle of his stomach, he was rushed to the hospital. Awaiting emergency surgery, he knew he was dying. He said goodbye to his wife and drifted into darkness. Standing up, he realized that he was between two hospital beds. He looked at Beverly, who was motionless, staring at the floor, sitting in the chair next to his bed. He spoke to her, but she didn't seem to hear. As he bent over to look at the face of the body in the bed, he was horrified to see the resemblance that it had to his own face. But he knew that was impossible, because he was standing over the person looking at him. Off in the distance, outside the room in the hall, he heard voices calling him. They were pleasant voices, male and female, young and old, calling to him in English. "Come out here," they said. "Don't you want to get better?" He stepped out into the hall, full of anxiety. The area seemed to be light, but very hazy, and he couldn't make out any details. He followed them, shuffling along in his bare feet with a memory of pain in his belly, yet feeling very much alive. The fog thickened as they went on, and it became gradually darker. Overwhelmed with hopelessness, he told them he would go no farther, and that they were liars. He could feel their breath on him as they shouted and snarled insults. Then they began to push and shove him about, and he began to fight back. A wild frenzy of taunting, screaming, and hitting ensued. As he swung and kicked at them, they bit him. Even though he couldn't see anything in the darkness, he was aware there were dozens or hundreds of them all around and over him, and that his attempts to fight back only provoked greater merriment. They began to tear off pieces of his flesh, and he realized that he was being taken apart and eaten alive, methodically, slowly, so that their entertainment would last as long as possible. In that wretched state, he lay there in the darkness. Suddenly remembering a prayer from childhood Sunday school class, he said, "Yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." To his amazement, the cruel, merciless beings were incited to rage by his prayer. They screamed at him, "There is no God! Nobody can save you!" But at the same time, they were backing away. He realized that saying things about God was actually driving them away, and he became more forceful. They became more rabid, cursing and screaming against God, but in time, they retreated back into that distant gloom beyond his hearing. Alone, destroyed, and yet painfully alive in this horrible place, he yelled out into the darkness, "Jesus, save me!" Far off into the darkness, he saw a pinpoint of light, like the faintest star in the sky. The star became brighter and brighter, and as it became closer, he realized that he was right in its path, and he might be consumed by its brilliance. This was a living being approximately 8 feet tall and surrounded by an oval of radiance. The brilliant intensity of the light penetrated his body. Ecstasy swept away the agony. Tangible hands and arms gently embraced him and lifted him up. He slowly rose up into the presence of the light, and the torn pieces of his body miraculously healed before his eyes. After Mr. Storm's near-death experience, he entered United Theological Seminary and was ordained as a minister of the United Church of Christ. Since 1991, he has been a pastor of Zion United Church of Christ in Cincinnati. He documented his near-death experience in the book My Descent into Death and a Message of Love, which brought me back. Wow, that's a long book title. But anyway, before his whole near-death experience, Howard Storm would describe himself as not being a very pleasant man. In fact, he says that he was a very hostile person, hostile to every form of religion and hostile to those who practiced it. He would often use rage to control everyone around him, and he didn't find any joy in anything. Anything that wasn't seen, touched, or felt, he had no faith in. He knew with certainty that the material world was pretty much the extent of everything that was. He considered all belief systems associated with religion to be fantasies for people to deceive themselves with. Beyond the three-dimensional world, there was nothing. But it's obvious that his experience completely transformed his life. Did he indeed go to hell? Did he just get a glimpse of it? Was he in some sort of purgatory? Or was he in, perhaps, a figment of his own imagination? Perhaps his deep buried conscience trying to come out during that moment of death? I don't know. I'm on the fence with this one. But it's an interesting example of a not-so-happy near-death experience. Many of the stories that you hear and read about, they involve the light and feeling wonderful and peaceful and visiting with past friends and family that have died and given messages of hope and love, and then they come back to life. Probably about 2% of all near-death experiences are considered negative ones, just like Mr. Storm's. So, if you want to read more about him, you can go to www.near-death.com/storm.html. I'll have a link up on my website. Check it out. It's pretty interesting stuff.
a tunnel and experienced a great sense of peace.
I was surrounded by bright white lights, and there were angels there right in front of me.
I saw a white horse, and he told me to ride him.
When I got to the other side, I could only describe it as pure love, really. And there was this horse who wanted me to ride it.
There was a horse who wanted me to ride him. He was quite insistent on that point.
At one point, I told the horse that I was tired. I think that was the wrong thing to say.
He certainly wasn't going to let me dismount. No. No, he wasn't. Nope. That was not an option.
I guess you always assume that horses are trustworthy, or at least congenial. Not this horse in particular, though.
Well, the horse raped me. Yeah.
I think it was when we were in the tunnel approaching the white light. That's when the rape happened.
I mean, it's a vision, right? So it's not like I was actually raped by a horse. Right?
I can safely say now that I fear death very much.
Very afraid of dying.
Don't look forward to it. Not if the real thing's anything like the warm-up, horse-wise, and rape-wise.
We don't know everything there is to know about near-death experiences, but we do know that they change people's lives. Kyle Dooley lost his job at the accounting firm. Evany Rosen dropped out of school, citing very, very personal reasons. And Bill Wood has made it his quest to turn the tables on the horses. Thus far, he has committed 14 acts of aggravated horse rape. He feels no regret.
I hope you enjoyed that one. That's a funny little skit performed by the Picnic Face group. They're Halifax, Nova Scotia group. And they do all kinds of improv and whatnot all around Canada. And they once in a while will put these little videos together. And that was a neat little one on near-death experiences. And apparently in Canada, Canadians get raped by horses when they have near-death experiences.
No, I'm just pretending to listen, like I do with my wife.
Back when I was a teenager, girls didn't go around shaking their booty, showing their boobs. There was no Girls Gone Wild. Oh God, look at this.
Back when I was a boy, video games only cost a quarter, and all you were was a dot who ate other dots.
Get things like who you are, where you are, why you're where you are, how'd you get to where you are, and where the hell'd you park the car? And if you walk too far, will you need some CPR? How'd your life get so bizarre, and how the hell'd you get that scar? Your life becomes filled with more questions than answers. Like what happened to the solid gold dancers? Should I get checked for cancer? Do you know where my pants are? And what the hell's a male enhancer? I don't need fashion tips from gay men, cause finally some of my clothes are back in style again. So now I just need to be a little more svelte and get rid of this gut that's hanging over my belt. I'm checking out the hottie in the checkout line. Her name is Melanie, but it's a felony for what I have in mind. That's a plan that I don't understand, how a 30-something turns into a dirty old man. But the worst feeling is the day you realize our elected officials are just spewing real lies. One is pure evil, so you can't vote for him, but the other one couldn't teach a duck to swim. Damn, it sucks to get old.
Uh-huh.
Damn, it sucks to get old.
Yep.
Damn, it sucks to get old.
Uh-huh.
Damn, it sucks to get old.
Yep.
Back in my day, Michael Jackson went on dates with Brooke Shields, and he made the most fantastical music. He was the king of pop, I tells ya. In my day, Yoda was a puppet.
Yeah, in my day, Yoda was a damn puppet. I do hope you enjoyed this podcast dealing with near-death experiences. It's one of those topics that I personally have just been always very interested in. And it's one of those things that I'm not sure if we're ever, ever going to be able to objectively prove what happens when a person is clinically dead and has one of these experiences. One of the most recent studies came out of the Netherlands, where Pim van Lommel and his doctors interviewed over 300 patients who were resuscitated after heart failure at 10 different hospitals across the country. 18% of them reported a near-death experience, but the team found no link between NDEs and drug use. The drugs used to treat the patients, the duration of the cardiac arrest or unconsciousness, or even the patient's reports of the degree to which they feared death before the incident. Van Lommel says, "This was an interesting thing. It's always said that NDEs are just a phenomenon relating to the dying brain and the lack of oxygen to the brain cells. But that's not true. If there was a physiological cause, all the patients should have had an NDE." His team then questioned the surviving NDE patients 2 years after their resuscitation, and then 8 years later. Most of the patients recalled the event in very striking detail, and most showed significant psychological changes, the team reported. The 23 NDE patients who were still alive 8 years later, quote, had become more emotionally vulnerable and empathic. You can read the story for yourself at New Scientist, and I'll put a link up to my website. But it's just one of those things where scientists and doctors have had so many personal experiences with their patients having a near-death experience where they get to the point where they have to study it. And their curiosity gets the best of them, and they wonder, is there something beyond here? If they can prove that near-death experiences are legitimate and true and are not reliant on the brain to occur, then what that means is that consciousness itself can exist independent of the brain. And that is extraordinary. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can go to my website at www.blazingtalons.com. Over to the right sidebar, you can see the link, the graphic there to Podcast Alley. Please vote for me. I think I'm losing to the Naked Scientists again. But every month, the voting starts over. I do want to thank all those that did vote for me last month. I ended up number 2 behind the Naked Scientists again. So, would love to beat them, and you can vote. Also, you can email me with any of your story ideas or maybe some personal experiences of yours. Maybe you saw a UFO. Maybe you yourself have had regression therapy and got to experience a past life. Or maybe you have had a near-death experience. So you can always email me at phoenix@blazingtalons.com. Or, if you want, you can be daring and call me at my hotline number, and that is 206-339-7125. You can call, leave a message, leave me a story, and if you want, I can play it during my next podcast. That would be great. Also, I don't know what the weather's like where you're at, but my God, it is freaking hot here. And so keep an eye out for my newest post, which will be coming out next week, where I got some help from a fellow blogger, and what we did was we decided to test our hypothesis. Is it hot enough to bake cookies in a Hyundai? And we believed, yes, it was freaking hot enough to bake cookies in a Hyundai. So check out the blog, keep an eye out for that post. So if you get the chance, go to the blog, look up that post. Should be up next week. As always, I'm your host, The Phoenix. I hope it's been fun and educational. You've been listening to The Phoenix Podcast, where science is stranger than fiction. Phoenix out.
Exciting and new, come aboard, we're expecting you, and love, life's sweetest reward, let it flow, it floats back to you. The love boat, soon we'll be making another run. The love boat promises something for everyone. Set a course for adventure, your mind on a new romance. Hurt anymore.
Unless you're raped by a horse.
It's an open smile on a friendly shore. It's love. Welcome aboard. It's love.
Good night, everybody.